Welcome to Attention Confidential, the podcast where we explore deep self-awareness, bold curiosity, and passionate advocacy for both ourselves and our communities.
In support of safety, please be advised that this podcast contains explicit language and direct or indirect references to material which some listeners may find triggering. Topics are highly personal and intimate, likely to touch on themes including but not limited to abuse, bigotry, body image, disability, mental health, sexuality, and trauma. Please prioritize your safety and the safety of those around you who may be exposed to this material, especially young folks. Please also note this is an ongoing project, which means I am actively engaged in learning while creating. The format, the tools, and skills to produce this material are all new to me. As I build and refine, I ask that you understand there may be kinks along the way. And because transparency is one of my core values, I should also share that I am using software that includes enhanced features to simplify the editing and post-production process. Any editing of this content, however, this original, organic, human-generated content, is done so at my discretion, specifically to optimize sound quality, not to manipulate, omit, or alter any substantive material in the recordings. All guests have a chance to review the material before it is published so they can be assured that their voices and stories are held and shared with care, treated as sacred things to preserve and pass on. You can find more details about each guest and relevant resources in the show notes for each episode.
Attention Confidential is sponsored, produced, and distributed by Self Magnitude LLC, an ethical microbusiness on a mission to transform how you see yourself. It is hosted by Maggie Green, personal brand and style strategist for weirdos and queerdos of all ages and gender expressions, who is also the face and voice behind Self Magnitude, helping people feel seen since 2020. If you're looking for support on embodying all aspects of your identity and showing up as your radically authentic self in person, in print, and online, please visit Maggie's 100% DIY website at selfmagnitude.com. Hey, weirdos and queerdos, and welcome to another episode of Attention Confidential, where we explore self-awareness, curiosity, and advocacy in a safe container. If you've been listening for a while, you know that those key themes are expressed as the mirror, the magnifying glass, and the megaphone, respectively. You also know that something special about this program is that guests have the opportunity to remain anonymous if that helps make them feel safe. Interestingly enough, this very first season, all guests have chosen to disclose their identity, which I consider a wonderful and generous gift. I'm feeling very grateful for that. And today's guest is no exception. They have chosen to share a little bit about themselves, including who they are by name. Before I reveal who they are, I should tell you this person uses she, her pronouns. I have known this person for almost 5 years. Lots of cool and interesting things that I could tell you about this guest, including the fact that they've written and published a literary work, an academic level literary work on the Golden Girls, which is pretty cool. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to Kate. Kate, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. Would you like to get us started by telling listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, hi, Maggie, and hi to Maggie's Weirdos and Queerdos. My name is Kate Harold, Kate Harold Brown, professionally. And I live and work in central Illinois, the unceded land of the Kickapoo, Potawatomi, Miami, and Peoria peoples. And I do a lot of things. I'm an instructional designer and a leader in e-learning and instructional technologies, which I got started by being the person in a law office who fixed the copier. So that's how I got started in that field, but also a writer and a musician, and I serve on some boards. I do a lot of things, and that is actually how people describe me. Kate does a lot of things. So I'm really glad to be here today.
Thank you for sharing about that. I'm excited that you mentioned writing. When I think about you, obviously, in the introduction, I referenced the fact that you're a published author.
I know writing is something that's really important to you, really personal. That's something that we share. When I think about the different pieces of writing of yours that I have come in contact with, I recall several pieces related to sobriety specifically. I'm curious if that's something that you might want to talk about a little bit. In particular, what changes or impact has sobriety had on your life inside the professional space and outside of that?
Yeah, thank you for asking. That's something that I don't often talk about, and not because I don't want to, it's just folks don't ask. So I appreciate you asking. I think just to go back a little bit, you know, I said I was an instructional designer by trade. There was a period of time, probably about 7 to 8 years ago, when I did a lot of writing about story, before and after stories. So particularly around weight loss, but also the ways that before and after stories function in lots of different areas of our life, including illness and disability, or just personal transformations. You know, you read a self-help book and then you're suddenly a different person. And then, you know, I have a TEDx talk about that. I did some writing about it. I described it to someone the other day as, you know, sort of on the path of influencer, but I never quite made it. So while I was doing that work, I also was kind of reevaluating my relationship to alcohol and wondering where that might go. And it occurred to me that the same kinds of stories that can harm people about weight loss success or disability or illness are also present in a lot of 12-step literature or the sort of rock bottom style story of sobriety. And maybe just like I identified the patterns that keep people from living their best lives under the thumb of diet culture, perhaps people were not identifying with recovery while they were navigating that relationship with alcohol, maybe doing some harm reduction steps or just in the what the popular news media calls sober curious. You know, we don't really call sober curious recovery. So, you know, realizing the effect of those stories on my life sort of moved me to a more professional place where I started talking about that and ways to move away from sobriety storytelling, which is the rock bottom, I got sober, I've been sober for X number of months, days, years, however long, to harm reduction storytelling, which is about that change in relationship, incremental changes in behavior, and really empowering people to recognize that, you know, even if they're not at their final goal destination of whatever that relationship with alcohol looks like, they're still in the recovery community and can celebrate wins, even if those wins aren't the same ones that are recognized in kind of 12-step program AA rhetoric and literature. So it just so happens that I am approaching a yearly anniversary of sobriety, but it doesn't mean that I am better than anyone else for making that. That was just a choice that I needed to make in my life for me. And there were several years before that where I did not fall under the total abstinence umbrella of sobriety, but I still was working toward changing my relationship with alcohol in a way that made me feel a lot better in my body. So yeah, that's a really roundabout way of saying that though that kind of storytelling has become a lot more important in my life. And now some of the work that I do in e-learning and instructional design is around helping organizations teach about harm reduction through a narrative teaching lens.
This idea of sober curious is really interesting to me. The stories that we tell about our relationship with various substances, coping tools, strategies. I don't know that I've heard the term sober curious before today. And just hearing your reflections about these kind of conventional stories around sobriety, you mentioned rock bottom and these different milestones or anyone who's out there, you know, exploring their relationship with alcohol in particular, how would you invite them in to a different kind of conversation? What does this actually look like? How might that story unfold?
It's a great question because I do think there is a bit of a barrier when you're hearing this from someone who identifies as sober or, you know, I've been sober for so many years. Like, well, you've done it, right? which is not entirely true, but you know, how can you, if I would say that if you are thinking that that is something that you might want or need in your life, you're already there. If you think about the stages of behavior change, contemplating change, I think is number two or three of the five steps. So it means you're already there. And thinking about it, if possible, you know, if it is available to you, thinking about if I'm interested in changing my relationship with alcohol and I've identified this as something that I want to do, what would it mean for me to be in recovery right now without any changing any behavior or anything? Just kind of a thought exercise of who would I be if I were in recovery, if I considered myself part of that, having that identity and being a part of a group of people who are in recovery. But again, no behavior change, no, you don't have to do anything. Just think about it. What might that feel like? And I think that can help reveal the next step, whatever that is for you. The other thing that I would suggest is a bit of a mindset shift around how we culturally, socially, particularly in the United States, the way that we think about alcohol as separate from other kinds of drug use. So in different kinds of substance use disorder recovery, there is this idea of a safe use site. So it is a place where people can go to use drugs in a safe and monitored and, you know, sort of, I don't know how to describe it, but basically there are places like that where drug users can go, people who use drugs can go and do that. They're generally very unpopular. People do not like safe use sites for the most part. And they are a really important part of recovery in terms of harm reduction. Because if you think about high risk behaviors that folks who use drugs might engage in, giving them a way to do that safely is a help, right? It does save lives. And if you think about alcohol use, bars in particular are safe use sites. You go to a bar to consume alcohol, and there is generally a person who, or multiple people, who will make sure that you do not drink too much, might offer you a cab home, or just there to monitor the behavior of others so that you don't get any negative consequences from being around folks who are inebriated, you know. And I think that's one of those mindset shifts of, oh yeah, we do offer places. We encourage people to visit places where they can consume alcohol safely. I mean, we have laws and regulations. You can't drive while under the influence, and you can only buy alcohol at certain places or certain times, depending on your municipality. I mean, we've put those things in place to keep people safer when they are consuming substances. So if you think about that in terms of what we accept culturally or not, you can apply the same thing to your own relationship with alcohol. Like, where do you use? Are there times or places or people that you're with where it's easier to moderate the way you want to, or places or with people in under circumstances that are harder to moderate? And recognizing that most people who drink are doing their own form of self-moderation to an extent that it becomes a problem in your life might be a question. But for the most part, people are already doing moderation. And if you are a person thinking about reevaluating your relationship with alcohol, those are just a couple things to think about. Again, no behavior change necessary. No, you know, super big revelation, epiphany needed. What would life look like if I consumed alcohol differently?
Really powerful. Had not ever considered or thought, you know, you suggested it as a mindset shift, like the idea of a bar as a safe use site. That is mind-boggling. It's wild. It absolutely is. And I appreciate you sharing those reflections as well, especially kind of where we are and everything that's happening right now. I think people, myself included, we're trying to figure out how the hell do we cope, right? And there are options, right? There's a plethora of options, including, you know, self-improvement and spending more time thinking about and just giving space to our relationship to ourselves even, right? Which is directly tied or indirectly tied to all these other things, these influences in our life. Again, tools, strategies, those kinds of things. Thank you, Kate, for sharing that. And thank you for sharing about your own sobriety. Okay. Moving into our next segment, which is all about curiosity, looking at something up close, studying the details of something, aka the magnifying glass. One thing that comes to mind, it's a little bit meta here. I think listeners will know by now, of course, this whole season, the show in itself, in part, was inspired by, informed by this road trip, which is completely a reductive term. Like, there's so much more to it. I think everyone knows by now, more than a road trip, more than an odyssey. But to kind of connect those dots, we had a chance to meet each other, actually spend time, share space with one another on this Tragic Optimist tour. And as I'm thinking about that experience, I thought it might be interesting to share that, you know, we're recording this conversation after the fact. It's many months down the road, pun intended, I guess. And one of the reasons why that happened, you might recall this, we, you know, had a pretty flexible afternoon, and had planned on, while we're together, we'll record an episode. And it turns out the time that we might have had to do that, you had multiple bookings, like overlapping bookings and demands on your time. So when I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking about neurodivergence, in particular ADHD, time management challenges, executive function / dysfunction, time agnosia also comes to mind. And I thought we might talk about that a little bit, if you're up for it.
Yeah, it's definitely something to be curious about. I received an ADHD diagnosis a few years ago. And the thing that sticks out about my report is that I have a moderately impaired visual scanning ability. I just think is a fun phrase to say. So I say it a lot. Basically, that if I'm looking for something in an email or in the fridge or scanning the horizon for something, I'm less likely to see it. I'm just going to not see what it is that I'm looking for. And I think that that was probably the one that maybe surprised me the most. I never really thought about that as a symptom of ADHD. And the more I find out about different neurotypes and how they manifest and different expressions of neurodivergence, like, oh, that's what that is. You know, I just thought that was a weird quirk. But no, it's actually sort of a dysfunction or a, maybe not even a dysfunction. It is a neurotype that is not well supported under capitalism.
Object permanence.
Right, which I always heard being applied to babies. You know, the babies have object permanence where if something is not right in front of them, it no longer exists. It's not in another room or under a bed or in a drawer. It simply does not exist. And I definitely feel like that is one of the ways that my ADHD expresses itself. I have to look at things. I have to have them right in front of me and in a way that does not necessarily make sense to others, but makes sense to me. Like, I was just telling someone the other day that I have to put things back exactly where I know that I can find them. Otherwise, I will not be able to find them. And my bag has a pocket for keys, a pocket for a wallet, a pocket for, you know, and it's just, if I can't do that, I'm all day long finding things. I'm on a trip right now and someone I'm traveling with noticed, oh, you spend a lot of time looking for things, right? Because I am not in my house and things are not where I expect them to be. On top of that is that I don't always do things right away. So I might have a very good intention to put my headphones back in the pocket where they go, where I'll find them again, but I accidentally leave them on the table and then I never look at them again and then go, where are my headphones? That is just one of those things about me. And I think it's similar for the time agnosia and not having a good sense of how long things take. I've tried to put some barriers in my calendar. Like, I know that I am less likely to look at my calendar until a certain time of day. So I've put it in a block so that I don't schedule any meetings before 9 a.m. Because by 9 a.m., I will probably be at work or I will have at least looked at my phone to remind me, oh, you have a meeting right now. But if it's before 9 o'clock, that meeting will pass me by and I probably won't look at it. And even when I schedule a meeting, I put in half an hour of focus time before the meeting and half an hour after, because I know that if I don't, I will just one meeting right after the other, right after the other. I don't like that feeling of not giving the person that I'm meeting with my full attention. I don't like it, but it happens all the time, which is what happened on your trip. You know, I thought I had I thought I had it all figured out. I was going to have this time in the afternoon, and then I don't even remember if something came up or I just misjudged the time or I was looking at the wrong day and told you I was free, but I actually wasn't. There was a lot of that, unfortunately, still in my life, but I try to trick myself as much as possible to give myself the space. And it reminds me a lot of a story that I grew up Catholic, and so I heard this story a lot. It's a parable sort of story about Jesus going to visit two sisters, I believe they're sisters, Mary and Martha. And Mary greets Jesus. They talk. She gives him her full attention. She's very present. And Martha is running around making tea and getting snacks and hanging up coats and just busying herself with all of the domestic tasks that are required when someone visits. And Jesus ends up chastising Martha for not giving her full attention to the visit. And Martha is basically like, well, yeah, well, who's going to make the tea if I'm not? Deep paraphrase, but she's upset because, like, well, but I'm doing all of these things so that we can have a good visit. So you have tea, so we have snacks, so coats are not on the floor, you know? And Jesus is like, yeah, but that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is being with the people who came to visit you. And I think about that all the time because I definitely get into the Martha trap of, but look at me, I'm busy doing things so that everyone can have a good visit, or so that the structures are in place. And I think if there were a curiosity to be had that sort of ties in our first segment is, despite being sober for many years, I do wonder how much of my ADHD was managed by alcohol. And now, in its absence, how is my anxiety manifesting in a kind of hyper-controlled ADHD managing kind of way that causes me to Martha-ize every interaction that I have with people?
Bless Martha. It's interesting because when you were saying, like, Jesus giving Martha a hard time about this, like, focus on the visit, in my mind, doing those things is absolutely like, I am, of course, I'm not present. I'm not enjoying the visit, as in just sort of like leisurely hanging out. But my full attention is absolutely dedicated to the visit. I want to make sure that's the perfect visit. Everyone has what they need, right? So that is interesting. And I wonder, have you had any experience with like balancing that? Have you been able to meet all the needs for the visit and the people involved and also be present and engage with the folks, like give them, that attention, that undivided attention, like you were talking about?
That's so funny that you bring this up because I never really thought of it this way before, but I think that I am giving my full attention to the visit. I mean, I am doing things. I don't know where this comes from or if it even needs to be, sort of analyzed, but I had a really hard time with small social interactions. I do not want to talk to people on the street or in the store. I'm probably okay at small talk, but I am not going to initiate a conversation out in the world. That's just not who I am. That's not what I'm going to do. And when I'm in my house, that is a deeply intimate space for me. And if I don't know my guests like super well, and I can't even say that there is no person who comes to my house that I would consider that I would be okay with not futzing around with. It's not like there are some people who fit that description and some that don't. It's just anyone in my house puts me on kind of high alert in terms of my social anxiety. So, yeah, if you ask me, yeah, of course I'm giving my full attention. I'm here, I'm doing, I'm preparing, I'm cleaning. And that's the only way that I'm going to be able to listen to the conversation and to participate when I feel comfortable to do so, because I have something to distract me a little bit, like take the edge off of the intense focus of small group conversation, because I just can't handle it. There is definitely a difference when my partner and I are hosting together because they are very present and they're great at conversation. They love hosting and having people over and having really intimate conversations with people and making them feel welcome in ways that are just not comfortable for me. So to see us together, probably to folks who value that Mary type intense conversation, that is the correct way to host people. My way is incorrect, I feel like. But it's not that I'm giving any less attention. It's just my attention is different. And I would hope that when folks visit, they know that that's just what I do. But I can see how it does or can give the impression that I'm not focused or that I don't care about the visit or spending time with people because I'm, you know, mowing the lawn or something. No, I don't mow the lawn when people are over. I actually don't mow the lawn. But I did. We had a full moon fire. We host those every month. And there was one where I absolutely had to get some planting done in the backyard because we were leaving for a big trip in a few days. And I just told everyone, I so appreciate that you're here. If you want to help me garden, great. But for the next hour, I'm going to be planting these things. So just FYI, this is where I'm at right now.
So much of what you're sharing just resonates. I'm like, yes, oh my gosh, I've been there, right? I was diagnosed with ADHD before kindergarten, but I'm thinking about college, like when anytime anyone would visit, you know, you're talking about like, it's indiscriminate, right? No matter who it is, there are people who, let's say it's like the in-laws, right? It's like a different degree of on edge, no matter who comes over, expected, scheduled, planned or not. It's this thing. It's a like a visceral reaction that happens. But I remember a friend of mine, really good friend of mine in college, made a comment about that at one point. He's like, can't we just like hang out? And I was like, I am hanging out, right? But it was like as
yeah.
someone comes in and they get comfortable and settle on the couch. And I'm like, I just popcorn right up and I'm like bodying around, you know? And it's the other thing that brings up for me is body doubling as a concept. There's like nothing that will motivate me more than like an impending guest or visit to do get shit done. But it's even more like that fire is lit once they're there. I'm like, cool. All right. So keep talking. I'm going to fold this load of laundry. I'm going to, you know, but it is like you were saying, it's not giving my attention. It's managing, you know, the demands, I guess, on my attention or the way it's divided. I don't know. It has to be divided. It can't be. Oh my gosh, that's hyperfixation territory right there, right? When something has 100% of your focus, and that can be tricky too. I don't know if that brings anything up for you or thoughts, but
yeah, it's interesting, the hyperfixation. I certainly experience that. I think it's a space where the hyperfixation is maybe the only time and space where I can allow my time agnosia to be okay. It's like not okay in any other moment of my life. But if I am by myself, I talk about what I need, you know, to relax. It's really hard for me to relax, but I need privacy and autonomy. And that doesn't have to be, you know, out in the woods for weeks at a time. It's the privacy and autonomy is like, don't look at my phone. I'm like, don't look over my shoulder at my phone when I'm dinking around on the internet. Like, that's privacy. And then the autonomy is like, if this half hour is for me to dink around on my phone and nobody's going to talk to me or ask me to do anything, or listening to an audiobook while I'm cooking, or just something like that, where it can be mine, my choice, and my space. And then I can give that whatever is happening 100% of my attention in a way that I'm not thinking about the next thing I have to do. And I think that's what, when people are visiting, I'm thinking about the next conversation, what is the next thing on our agenda, what, you know, what isn't getting done because I'm doing this, you know, which is not very generous, but it's a reality of my life. I'm always sort of focused on what's the next thing, because I have to be so aware of what time it is, how long something's going to take, what I'm going to do when I'm there. You know, it just takes a lot of effort to do that. And so when I am hyper fixated on something, it is such a relaxing space for me because of the autonomy, because of the privacy, and because I don't have to think about what comes next, how long, you know, like, how long am I doing this thing right now? And how long has it been since I've done something else? It's just a very freeing space that I don't let myself get into as often as I think I need to, which again, bringing up the sobriety, like that was one of those places where I had privacy, autonomy, and the hyperfixation is going out. I wasn't much of a home drinker. I was a going out kind of drinker. You know, it gave me that space that I needed, that, and I think not even just the brain chemicals that alcohol is trying to regulate. It was trying to regulate that need, those three needs of privacy, autonomy, and the space for hyperfixation.
That's very interesting, particularly the privacy piece, like out in a public or a social space. You know, you can be alone in a room full of people. That is possible, you know?
Yeah, and I'm actually better, outside of my own house, or actually anybody else's house. But if we're at a park or a restaurant or like a third space kind of location and a neutral third place, then I don't, all of those things that I worry about at home aren't present. And I think it is partly the social anxiety of, am I good enough? Is my house good enough? Are you comfortable here? Are we talking about the right things? I worry a lot about that, which doesn't exist elsewhere. So a lot of that pressure is off, and there's no need to do that sort of busying. And I would like to think that, the friends that I see often just know that about me, and maybe we don't meet at a house. We go somewhere else.
Right, a neutral space, low pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
Well, it's also the novelty. I think that's another ADHD type of thing, the sensory seeking, the novelty, like, ooh, this is fun for me because it's a break from my everyday. We are in a location that I where I don't have any responsibilities, or I don't have to be any kind of way. I can just be a bit more anonymous in my behavior because nobody expects anything from me at this restaurant.
Yeah, I definitely relate to that as well. You know, routine is lovely. I don't know what I would do without it. Love routine. Love, you know, my space is curated to meet my needs, right? But it also has certain implications. Like when I'm in this space, I am not a different person, but like you were saying, it's a different set of expectations, both from others, potentially, or maybe that's my perception, right? Other people's expectations of me in this space, but certainly of myself. And I wonder if there are others out there who have shared that experience as well. And if that's the case, like, what are those third places, right? Maybe for someone who's, let's say, sober curious or who is in recovery, where do you go if you don't go to the bar, right? Where is your safe third place, your go-to space to be free?
Yeah, it can be really hard. I understand that bars or any kind of place where alcohol is being consumed is not available to a lot of folks in recovery. It happens to be available to me. I also realize as part of this storytelling that around sobriety, we drink all the time. We just made a distinction between drinks that contain alcohol and those that don't. And once I was able to embrace that, actually, I love the rituals around drinking even more than I like the alcohol. That really opened up a lot of doors for me, so that I can go to a bar, but I don't a lot anymore because it's too late. Activities happen too late these days. And I've really appreciated, some of our local bars have kind of happy hours or just activities that are earlier in the day. And I still really like socializing in bars. And I have to, even just in the couple of years that I haven't been drinking, the explosion of non-alcoholic options is really great and makes those spaces a lot more accessible for the folks whose recovery plan can include socializing in alcohol consumption sites. So I really enjoy that. And I think also being honest with yourself about what the drinking brings you. Like, I like being outside of my house. Like I said, the ritual of doing a shot or cheers or drinking something out of a fancy glass, or just I love those things. And so I do those things just with drinks that don't have alcohol in them. My favorite kind of option if I'm out, and some of these things are high pressure, which can be overwhelming for people, like, hey, let's do shots, but you don't want to say no thanks. And I hate saying no thanks. Like, that was one of the things that kept me drinking for so long, is that I didn't want to have to say no all the time. I wanted to say yes. And I do think that is part of my ADHD expression of like, yeah, I'm doing it. I'm a cool person who does things. And so before I was faced with that situation, I thought, well, what would I say if somebody offered me a shot or said, let's do shots? And I came up with cranberry juice, because almost all bars have cranberry juice, and it still gives you the tang of an alcoholic shot. And I don't think anybody would be like, what are you drinking? It would be weird about it. Like, just a shot of cranberry. Okay. And that's been pretty effective for me, but feeling like I got a little bit off track there. I guess it's just thinking that, and we've talked about this a lot in our work together too, is some things just don't fit. They're just not the right one. And if there's something, if you, I don't know, if you want to reevaluate your relationship with alcohol, but there's some resistance to it, or you're like, I don't really want to, or it's not the right time. Like, well, what is the thing that you're looking for? And is there an analog out there somewhere that you need? Like, do you need to be around people? Do you need to get out of your house because your house is too overwhelming? Do you just want, do you not have enough fun in your life and you're looking for a way to have fun? I mean, there's all kinds of ways to do that. And I know that that was really important to me. The other thing that was important to me was that as a musician, I couldn't imagine doing a gig without a beer. It just seemed impossible. And again, when I started this journey, the only viable option was O'Doul's malt beverage beer substitute. And so I couldn't wrap my head around how can I get through a gig without alcohol. And then I learned that Bonnie Raitt, famous blues guitarist and pop star, has been sober for over 25 years. And I thought, well, if it's good enough for Bonnie Raitt, it's good enough for me.
Oh,
And
yeah.
that's all it took. That was it.
Love that.
Love Bonnie Raitt as well. Oh my gosh. As we move into our final segment, bittersweet, the advocacy segment, which we call the megaphone around these parts. There's something that when I think about you, topics that you might have unique perspective on, I feel like we should talk about AI. You mentioned you're in instructional design. Obviously, you're in the higher ed space as it intersects with technology. Very curious, you know, in the spirit of advocacy, what do people need to know? What's not being talked about that we should talk about? What are your thoughts? It's a big topic.
It is a big topic. I think the number one kind of shout from the rooftops megaphone moment that I would share around AI is that the skills that require people will still be needed no matter how sophisticated AI gets. And I think the way that I've approached this in my teaching and in my own advocacy, I'm not an AI all technology all the time kind of person. In fact, I try to go as low tech as possible, because in the collapse, in the meta crisis, you know, how I always think, how would we do this without technology? How did people do this without technology? Those are the kinds of skills and connections and behaviors that are not only going to be the ones that we revert to in the post-technological era, but also the ones that bring the most connection between people. So it's really important to me, for however useful AI can be, to use it in a way that fosters connection between people rather than replacing human labor or human connection. It's how can we use this as a supplement to make our lives more meaningful? And there's a big tendency to fall into that trap of, well, if it's making things more efficient, then our productivity can increase and we don't actually get around to the connection part. But I think a more mindful use of AI or any kind of technology should be one that fosters connection and increases quality of life for people, rather than continue, you know, make more space for the never-ending grind of capitalism. So that's kind of my thing, is like, how are you using this to enhance your quality of life or your connection with others?
I'm so glad you brought it back to capitalism. Anytime I hear the word productivity, that's where my brain goes, right? There are all kinds of different ways in which
businesses pursue more, better, faster all the time? Like, how do we make things more efficient? How do we quote unquote optimize? And I really appreciate your reminder that technology is not a replacement. It's absolutely a supplement that, you know, without humans, so much of what needs to happen wouldn't be possible. And that's no matter what the infrastructure looks like, no matter what the landscape looks like, humans make it happen. I'm curious, how are you seeing it used for good in your own work?
At the community college that I work at, we started a program for our health sciences, particularly our nurses, to use VR simulation. Now, this isn't AI necessarily, but I think a lot of the nursing simulation or healthcare simulations are incorporating AI into those simulations. But we have this VR simulation that all of the nurses in this particular class go through. And in nursing education, there are often simulations or clinical labs or practice, skills practice that students go through. So this part isn't new, but the VR one is new. And for the first time in the history of the program, which is only a couple of years old, but for the first time, we had the emergency EMS, the paramedic, or the emergency medical services students who are going out into the field as EMTs. They did the same simulation with the nursing students. So we had EMS students and nursing students in the simulation together, and all of the students did the same simulation. And what was really cool about that wasn't just that the students did the simulation, because you're not really going to learn anything about administering an IV or doing CPR in the simulation. But what happened is that afterwards, all of these students, and I think there were about 65 students in this big room, talking with their professors about what they learned while in the simulation. So they talked about their leadership skills, their clinical judgment skills, when they knew to act, when something went wrong and they needed to step in, and, you know, the sort of metacognition around the learning that they did in the simulation. And I just brought a tear to my eye, because that's exactly what I'm talking about when I say that these experiences should bring people together. Because if you think about these 65 students who might all be doing clinical work at different sites, different hospitals or clinics, or, you know, they're not going to be able to come together and have a common shared experience that they all went through together to be able to talk about those, you know, soft skills or communication skills or non-technical skills that they need, not just in the process of doing their jobs, but in talking to people and connecting with other human beings. Because at the end of their programs, they're going to go out into the field, into emergency situations, into all kinds of places where these are high stakes scenarios where they're actually interacting with people. And now, because of that simulation, they've had an experience where they get to learn more about themselves and how they work with others and the thought processes of other people to enhance their communication out in the field. So, you know, that's one of those places where I see that there's a huge opportunity to use technology to bring people together and learn in cross-cultural and cross-functional ways. And if we're only focused on technology as getting you through this training faster or more efficiently or at scale, we're really missing out on something important.
So heartwarming and touching that people from the same relative industry, but in very different fields, like work streams, being able to share that experience. That is really, really cool. We spoke in the Magnifying Glass segment about neurodivergence and how that expresses itself and manifests in your life and your personal experience. So one of the things that I've thought about is the ways in which this tool can be used to enhance quality of life. And you were talking about human connection. I'm also thinking about for people who are physically, socially isolated, alone, maybe there are barriers to access, you know, resources like human connection for them. In what ways do you see AI being a positive influence for maybe a person who's alone and having challenges with scheduling or, you know, things like that?
Yeah, I think at this moment, you know, it's not really there yet. There is a possibility that it could be. And we hear all these sensational stories about the AI, you know, different chatbots or things that are saying horrible racist things or encouraging people to harm themselves or others, you know, that sort of thing. And I don't think that those risks should be ignored in favor of the ways that it can help. But I do think that there is a lot of potential for help, even in terms of being able to practice a difficult conversation or the same kinds of things that the nursing and EMS students were doing, you know, developing the kinds of skills that will make it easier or more productive or better going out into the world and interacting with others. So I call it the device. When I use ChatGPT, I call it the device, and I have been using it to practice my French. And it's not that I think that this device is going to be representative of every person that I will speak French to, but it gives me the practice that I need that I wouldn't get otherwise talking to people. And it will enhance my conversations with those people because I'm not just sticking to the device. And I think that in terms of the barriers or the social, you know, the ways that a persona can or an avatar can stand in for real humans, I don't think that we're that far off. I mean, if you take this back in history away from just the 21st century kinds of AI, I mean, how many people started having parasocial relationships with radio figures in the 30s and 40s? You know, these people that they heard in their homes and on records every day, every week, they became figures in life. And I don't think that the AIs are that far off. And maybe it's because, you know, I think about my grandmother was born in 1925. So she was born in a time before, like while radio existed, records existed, but before TV. And then in her 70s and 80s, watching Bob Barker on The Price is Right every day and would talk about these characters on TV as if she knew them in real life. So we're only a couple of generations into a space where having parasocial relationships with digital figures is part of our day-to-day already. So I don't see that much difference between the AI. It's possible that it's different because of how it may or may not generate conversation, but the technology behind it, the large language models and the predictive text, it's not, at this point, creating much that's new. If anything, it's just kind of recycling what we already had. So to me, it's just a new form of the same kinds of relationships we've been used to having our whole lives.
Yeah. I think about ethical implications. I know we've had some conversations about this, like directly related to your work in higher ed. Again, this is kind of meta, but like when I say we need to talk about AI, like businesses, institutions, entities, organizations, leveraging this as a tool, being forthright about that and transparent, mm-hmm. as opposed to some kind of masquerade or like we're trying to like trick someone into believing this is an authentic human personality versus, you know, like an AI generated message. I saw just this morning, it was from a subreddit called Mildly Infuriating, where someone in the job market, prospective employees hunting for jobs and has just had this great interview experience and then gotten a rejection letter where the canned text was just reproduced. It wasn't personalized.
Yeah, I took a screenshot of that post.
Did you? I did the same thing. I was going to send it to you. That's funny. So I think about that. Like, obviously, this business, they've got their wires crossed. They have not thought this through at all. I don't know if I can think of examples where it's been done well, but there are a lot of horror stories and like what not to do here. I'm curious what your perspective is on that. Maybe what advice you might give people who are trying to integrate this tool into their business model.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, I'm on the edge of creating a whole project around this. It's the transparency that really gets me, because I was just thinking about how we went on a ferry. We're on a trip and sort of a place where you have to take a ferry to get to the other side of where you need to be. And so we were on the ferry and, you know, they have the voice that comes on and says, "Welcome to the ferry. keep your hands and arms and then whatever, the kind of safety message that they give at the beginning of the trip. And I thought, I don't have any illusions that that's an actual person speaking into a microphone. I know that that's a recorded voice, whether that was a human person who recorded it or some kind of AI generated voice or digitized voice. I'm not feeling duped or taken advantage of because it's a pre-recorded voice. What makes the difference between that kind of voice, which we hear all the time in different places, versus feeling cheated by an automation or an AI when we expected a human person? And I think that the difference, it relates to something that I learned about in my studies around autobiography and memoir. It's a concept called the autobiographical pact. And the autobiographical pact, I feel like it's harder to describe than it is to understand. So I hope listeners understand what I'm saying here. The autobiographical pact is basically when you are interacting with a piece of media, let's say a book in this case. So you read an autobiography. There is an unspoken contract between you and the author and the book that says that this piece of writing is written by the person whose name is on the cover as the author. That person is a real person, and they are sharing real experiences that actually happened to them in their actual life. And we don't really think about this too often when we are reading autobiography until it's discovered that there's something false about it. Some of the controversies around, like, James phrase "a million little pieces" probably a decade ago, 15 years ago, this memoir about substance use. So he got in a lot of trouble because he was found to have fabricated some of these stories. And so he broke the autobiographical pact. We don't trust him anymore. And I just heard he came out with a new book, which I haven't read. They addressed that controversy. Like, it sticks. It's something that really sticks with people if you have broken the autobiographical pact. So when you have something like an email is not the same thing as a safety announcement on the subway, right? You expect that an email is from the person. Well, first of all, the author of the email is an actual person, and that person is writing this message that is theirs to you. And it's the presumption of something very one-on-one, very intimate. And when that is broken because of pasted language or an automation or something like that, you lose people's trust the same way that authors lose trust in an autobiography. And so if people are trying to integrate automation into their business model, I highly recommend, it's not that you can't, I encourage it. I think it's a good use of resources, especially if you are an entrepreneur or a creative or somebody working with people who may have some neurodiversity or executive functioning challenges. It could be really helpful for this. But there are ways to make that communication more transparent when you describe what's going on. So I don't recommend that people use an email automator and try to make those emails seamless as they're coming from you, or they're coming from you and that you have handwritten every word of it. And that's partly because the technology will fail. It will glitch on you. You will send an email that you didn't mean to send, or it will have the tag in the wrong place, and someone will have not filled out your form completely, and you don't have a last name for them, and it just leaves a big blank space or puts "insert last name here." And that's going to break trust in a way that completely negates any of the gains that you made in the automation. So I encourage people to find ways to do that that really fit with your brand. And one of the easiest ways, and something that I have done, is that sometimes I just put a robot emoji in the subject of the email, or in the body of the email, I will have a little header that says, "The following message has been approved by Kate Bot." Something like that. So the people know that this message comes from me, is part of my ecosystem, but there is an automation element in it, so that if it breaks, I'm less likely to lose the trust of my audience.
I love that. This message has been approved by Kate Bot. That's very clever. And I like that you suggested alignment with the brand as well. Trust is so important right? Broken trust is really hard to repair, especially when it comes to, you know, clients and business development. So to acknowledge it, it kind of sets that expectation. You were involved. You're not trying to trick anyone or whatever. I really appreciate that. And I hope that folks who are out there who are listening, whether they own their own businesses or, you know, are part of teams who are programs putting these kinds of things in place, you know, that's a really powerful suggestion. Puts a little humor back into it as well.
Yeah, that's certainly on brand for me. I'm working on a project right now where we're using digital voices, AI-generated voices, to read the narration of our content. That makes a lot of sense from a business perspective because, yes, if you hire voiceover actors or you use voices of people who are in your organization, if some of that content changes, it may be difficult to get that re-recorded. But I didn't want, and because the voices are so lifelike now, they're not, this is, I am reading this thing to you. I am an actual human. No, they're very lifelike now. So I created a slide in the e-learning presentation where I explained that, you know, this lesson is delivered by avatars with digitized voices that represent the team. You know, these represent the team that's putting together this research. When you see this icon, and I've associated an icon with those digital voices, this is being read to you by a digitized voice. And I don't say AI voice, just digitized is fine because that's what it is. But there are definitely ways to do that that don't compromise your automation. It doesn't take that much more effort to put in, but is a little bit of an insurance policy for both sides that people, you know, can you imagine like recording something and then somebody develops a parasocial relationship with the voice that they think is real? Like they think it's an employee at your organization and they're like, hey, can I talk to so-and-so? What are you going to do then? So they're not in ever. So you're really painting yourself into a corner if you do that sort of thing. But that's why I suggest that even if you name your business's chatbot or, you know, you give it that personalization, you also explain, you know, that this is a bot. This is the way we collect information. This is how we do things. And I don't think that having a personalized or I love characters, especially in things like e-learning or content creation or, you know, as a Clippy. I love Clippy from Microsoft Office of, you know, the late 1990s. I love Clippy. Everybody knows Clippy is not a person because Clippy is a paperclip. So I just think, If you're going to do that, spend some time thinking about what is the role of this avatar or this technology in our business and how might we expect people or how do we want people to interact with this component of the business?
Thank you for that. And I'm excited to see what happens next, how this evolves. I'm excited for more conversations about it, more research and learning. If you're not thinking about it or talking about it, now is definitely the time for sure. So calls to action. This is the note that I always like to end on. You know, we've touched on several things in this conversation, and I want listeners to be able to take not only the learning and the insight, but like put something into practice. Like now that we know these things, what do we do?
I think all of my advocacy or things that I hope for people comes back to the ways that stories have power over us. And sometimes that power is for good, and sometimes it is for making us feel bad about ourselves and others. And I think a pretty practical sort of thing that touches on all of the different things that we've talked about today is to find those places in your life where the stories have power over you that you don't want it to have, and be honest with yourself about it. So if you like a certain thing, or you need things a certain way, or certain kinds of social interactions don't work for you, it's okay that they don't. And maybe finding those places where, like, where is the story? What story am I believing about how this makes me a good or bad person is influencing my choices around it? Because there are so many different kinds of ways to be. And I know that when I was, anytime that I have thought about changing my life, I have looked to other people's stories. And even when I was a kid, very, very under the thumb of diet culture. I remember reading memoirs that adults had written about how they'd overcome a particular situation. And I thought, well, if I do it just like them, then I'm going to be okay because they've already figured it out. But knowing the stories behind it and how they are just stories, we have the power to create our own stories. And I really think that that is what is going to save us all in the end, is recognizing that if we can tell better, more life-affirming stories about ourselves and each other, then overall quality of life is going to increase. And I think a lot of the problems that people have with AI right now are, I just read a story about one of Elon Musk's, Grok is doing something weird. And, the large language models that AI is using come from different kinds of stories and literature and news articles, and every piece of human writing it can get its hands on are not our best stories. And this is a time that we can write some new stories. And I think it begins with everybody doing their own self-awareness. And then how can I take this affirming, positive, connecting story and share that with more people? And that is the true power. That is the best power that stories can offer for our protection as a species and protection against the forces that want to make us believe that there is something wrong with us. So there's nothing wrong with you. It's okay to be who you are and how you need things to be, and tell that story.
The original music, as featured on Attention Confidential, was written, composed, and produced by Christopher Colley Biondi, a deaf pianist, composer, and dear friend in Central Kentucky, who generously provided his skills and talent to support the launch of this podcast. That's all for this episode of Attention Confidential, but of course, the conversation doesn't end here. I encourage you to keep exploring, keep questioning, and most of all, keep sharing your stories. If today's conversation spoke to you, please pass it on. And if you have a story of your own you'd like to showcase, I am here and ready to listen. You can find all past and future episodes at selfmagnitude.com/podcast. And until next time, remember this. Your voice matters.